Welcome to the Leeds Church Institute podcast. To find out more about the Leeds Church Institute, visit lcileeds.org.
Our guest speaker is Dr. Lynn Bassett, and Lynn has worked as a healthcare chaplain in both acute and palliative care settings. And throughout all that time, my impression is she's been a very reflective practitioner, to the extent she's actually gained a PhD, and that's been on exploring silence as an element of end of care, end of life care. So Lynn will be sharing from the richness of her experience and practice. I'm now going to put myself on mute and hand over to Carol and Lynn.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks very much, Helen, for that introduction. And of course, we're also delighted that we've been able to work with the Church Institute. And I'm also delighted to have Lynn here eventually, even though we had this all planned in March. So I'm just going to ask Lynn to begin with, as a beginning more of our conversation, I hope, this morning, to say a little bit more about herself and also to tell us a little bit about the Centre for the Art of Dying Well.
It's really lovely to be here at last, even virtually. I was a hospital chaplain. I was started as a volunteer. I was what they called a chaplaincy visitor. I think providentially, I then got a small job as a hospital chaplain, Roman Catholic hospital chaplain in Watford. And that grew like topsy over a couple of years. I ended up with four hospitals and a hospice included. A little later on, I moved on. I dropped three of the hospitals and kept the hospice at one other hospital, which was cancer specialism. And I worked as spiritual care coordinator in an independent hospice for 5 years. And so it was. A little after that, I retired early, I'm embarrassed to admit, but actually it gave me that opportunity to focus on my PhD. I don't think I would have ever completed it if I had carried on working one day a week. It was really not realistic. So about 18 months later, I completed my research into silence in spiritual care at the end of life. And here I am. I've been working with the Art of Dying Well pretty much ever since then in different ways. I don't know how much you know about the Art of Dying Well. Again, it's a Catholic foundation, but it's open to all. It was established by the Bishops' Conference. It now sits very comfortably under the auspices of St. Mary's University College, Twickenham. What you would see as a layperson is a website, and it's a fantastic resource, whether you're terminally ill, whether you're accompanying someone who's terminally ill, whether you're bereaved, or if you just want information about death and dying. There's videos, there's podcasts, there's very, very accessible information. Of course, this is all backed by serious research, expertise of professionals, and we've got lots of connections with the Demos think tank, with the SVP, most excitingly. I've just come out of a meeting with the SVP where that's the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. It's a charitable society that cares for the poorest, the marginalised, the bereaved and the ill in our society all over this country and wider. And we're going to be doing training for death and dying companions, people who will accompany people in the community, in parishes, in hospitals, just to make people feel a little more comfortable with that notion of being with someone who is reaching the end of their life.
Thanks, that's great. And that's some things that I didn't know about the Art of Dying Well website. So I'm sure that resource will be shared on the Church Institute website as well. We're in a very different position from March, and I wondered, I'd like to ask you how you think our approach to death, dying and bereavement has changed in the light of the pandemic of COVID-19.
I think it's an unfolding experience, and I think we still have to see how it ends up, But initially, death just became so much more a regular feature of everyday life. I kind of noticed there was almost like it was coincidental with the V-Day celebrations, wasn't it? There was almost a wartime spirit. Everybody pulled together. There was a lot of concern for people who had lost loved ones in a situation that we just hadn't experienced, probably in my lifetime. I think it was a moment where probably we all felt that sense of our own mortality started putting things in order. What goes on now? I'm not so sure. Will our experience be the same as we go through this second wave? I think definitely there's a change in the way that people think they want to go on living. There seems to be less cooperation with the idea of just shutting ourselves indoors. And I wonder whether dying is so much on the agenda. I think we're all comforting ourselves at the moment with the thought that the hospital deaths aren't so very great. My fear is that will change. Before the pandemic, death was pretty much a taboo, wasn't it? It had been very medicalized, something removed from everyday experience. And quite often people thought of it as a conversation to be avoided. So around about March time, when I was going to come and speak with you, it would have been very much around this sort of notion of how comfortable do you feel sitting by the deathbed of a loved one? And at the Art of Dying World, we produced this handy little card called Deathbed Etiquette, which suggested ways of being with someone who was very unwell and maybe tried to allay some of the fears that we feel, the obvious ones, the difficult breathing, the should they be asleep, are they getting colder, and those sort of things. Well, of course, we had to revise that because we've been trying to encourage people to sit with their loved ones, and suddenly COVID-19 came along and suddenly people couldn't sit with their loved ones anymore. They might not even be allowed into the hospital. It was horrendous. So then we're talking about, well, how can you be with and be there for your loved one if you can't actually physically be there? And actually the things you do and think and reflect on are probably much the same, but it's about the separation. And meanwhile, of course, hospitals were providing phones and tablets in any way they could of trying to facilitate those conversations, passing messages, liaison officers. It was also important. And I really, really hope that we have learned from all of that if we have to start doing it again. Maybe we appreciate more than we did those precious moments that people actually can spend with loved ones just before they die.
Then you mentioned this whole area of the taboo about talking about death and people avoiding it. Do you think because of this experience that we've been through, there has been more talk about death, more awareness since March?
I think there definitely has, and at different levels. I think if you Googled death around about July, you saw this spike going up. But I mean, my personal thoughts are that was largely because death has been in the news, and you can't get away from those 43,000 plus deaths, plus probably more non-COVID deaths that we've all witnessed in these last few months. It's massive. Secondly, we've seen the effects. We've seen the effects on our hospitals, our healthcare staff, our funeral directors, our communities, our churches, everything around the way that death is managed seems to have been shaken and changed. And we have noticed that people are asking more questions about death and dying as well. The hits on the Art of Dying World website have definitely gone up. But thirdly, on a personal level, I think most of us know someone who's died from COVID-19 during the last 6 months. I certainly know of more than two handfuls of people who've died from various causes over the last 6 months. And the experiences of bereavement have been different. it doesn't matter what the death has been. The funeral has been different. The possibilities of whether you've spent time with that person just before they've died have been different. Everything has changed. It's almost as if COVID-19's put a magnifying glass on the subject of death, I think.
It's curious, isn't it? Because every winter, thousands of people die from flu and from other seasonal illnesses. Death has been always with us, but yet this curious thing has happened. Why do you think that is?
I think it's the dimension of the pandemic. I mean, it's all over the world, and it's all over our news all the time. And it's impacted on all of us, being in lockdown, the things we have to do, the wearing the masks, the sanitising the hands. You only have to listen to my little three-year-old granddaughter, and she's got a whole vocabulary that we would have never thought of. Satinising, she calls it. And you know, she talks about her bubble at nursery. We've all changed beyond belief. We don't do all the things we used to do, and this has particularly affected the elderly. We don't get to go to church. We maybe get to go to church now, but we don't get to go to church in the way that we used to go to church. We run in, we try not to talk to anybody, we run out at the end. It's affected every dimension of our daily life. And I think every time it affects us, there's always this underlying notion that there's the ever-present possibility of death for ourselves, for a loved one, for someone we care about.
Mm. It's really interesting about children as well, isn't it? Because, yes, my granddaughter, I think, has probably asked more often, is anybody going to die? Who's going to die? Is my mother, who's her great-grandmother, is she going to die because she's old? And so I think we've had to think of that as well, really, haven't we? And kind of cope with children asking more about death and think how we're going to respond to that.
She's probably positive because, you know, what we were struggling with before was the fact that people wouldn't talk about death. Mm. So it's good. And the way you answer those questions will reflect on the rest of their lives. So that's important.
Mm. And I think children are really good because if you're honest with them, and as I'm sure people experience, and just answer their question honestly, they then move on. They're not looking for any great philosophical answer to anything, really. We started to talk a little bit about faith and our experience of going to church. What do you think our faith can bring to this understanding of death, dying and bereavement, particularly in these times?
Well, our faith is a source of hope, especially, you know, the Christian faith and others, that death isn't the end, but there is life which continues beyond. And that light of faith, that light of hope certainly has carried me through these 6 months or more. But of course, we know also that when you're really hit by a personal bereavement or by your own mortality, that light of faith can get a bit dim for some, not for all, obviously. But, you know, speaking of my experience in hospitals, even the most religious people are not exempt from that Garden of Gethsemane experience where it just feels like God has gone indoors for a bit. So faith brings comfort. Faith can be challenging. It's not linear. It's not always there quite how we expect at the time. It is something that we can offer to other people. So the power of other people's prayer for me when I can't pray very well, I find just phenomenal. So I think, you know, the key praying is really important. But of course, for other people, faith raises awkward questions. So one of the awkward COVID questions could well have been, oh, what's happened now that my loved ones died in hospital? They weren't able, in my tradition, they weren't able to receive the last rites. But this will apply to many people who have an expectation of having some religious ministry at the end of life. You know, is that just disaster? So there's reassurance needed there. There's tricky medical questions, aren't there, and misconceptions. You know, are the doctors doing all they can? Is it because I'm old that I'm not getting the same as someone else? Now, I firmly believe that the doctors really are doing all that they can. And, you know, it's so easy to be clouded when you're really concerned for a loved one. I remember when my mum died, I was angry to the point of unreason because I felt that they popped her in and out of hospital like a yo-yo and it was totally inappropriate. And it probably was, but I still can't to this day unpack how much my anger was fueled by my own bereavement and how much it was a genuine case. Some people kind of hang on to the fact that the church teaches that life should be prolonged at all costs, even when it's really uncomfortable, and the churches tend not to. The churches talk about dignified death, not obviously disproportionate medication, but you know, if you need medication, you need medication. Do I have a right to treatment? Well, no, I have a right to decline treatment, but you can only be treated in the best way that the doctors feel is appropriate. What does the church teach? Do we know? Well, we can find out. We've got lots of time to Google, and we can ask our ministers.
How can we offer support to people in their bereavement at this time?
I think a lot of what we've done during this pandemic, and a lot of that which affects all of this subject, and particularly bereavement, is about creativity. So during lockdown, we saw a burgeoning of online, look, here we are, ways of continuing to communicate and support with one another, ways of going to church, ways of having our prayer groups. And this too, it provides us with ways that we can support our bereaved. So you could have a Zoom support group. I think in November, I've already seen notifications for a load of online live streamed remembrance services. We were, or we are in this week, I think we're in Baby Loss Remembrance Week, and there's lots going online for that. I've also been supporting people one-to-one over the phone. Now, it's not quite the same as face-to-face, but if it's the only phone call you're going to get all day and you're on your own and you're isolated and you're bereaved, it's well worth it. I've known several people who've lost spouses during this time and had to go home from the funeral alone. I think that's the hardest thing, and I think that's a real challenge. What can we do in our churches to think about that and cover for that eventuality? Suddenly, not only have you lost the one you lived with, but you can't, your daughters are down the road, but you can't see them, and you're just sitting in a room on your own. That's really, really difficult. I think whatever we can do, and it's practical help, isn't it? It's the casserole on the doorstep, but also the phone call. I think the phone call has perhaps been, I'm not very good on the phone. You'll notice I'm not very good on Zoom. I hate picking up the phone. So in my mind, I've equated it with that sensation where you see someone who's recently lost their husband or wife, and you're walking along the street and you think, oh no, I just don't know what to say to them. Oh, I think I'll just pop in this shop. And it's the same. I mean, don't do it. I try not to. Just say something, say hello. You don't have to say any great wisdom. You don't have to necessarily even say, I'm sorry for your loss. Just be there as you've always been for those people. And it's the same. However hard it is, pick up the phone. Just sing to see if you're all right. Judge whether they want to carry on a conversation or actually whether it's not convenient or appropriate at that time, but at least you've called. There's one lady I phone and she says, I am so thankful for your call. I wake up on a Monday morning and I know you're going to call and that changes my life. That's quite humbling. But, you know, it's just worth doing, isn't it?
I think the thing about phone calls is really interesting because we've become, my exchange with some of my friends and family is that we use texting and we use WhatsApp, but do we actually speak to people? But then the advantage of this new way is that I find myself making appointments to ring people, because that time when the landline rang and you wished you could just let it go onto answer machine. So there's a whole different etiquette, isn't there, about using the phone and using the advantages of technology to make the best of it. One of the other things I think is interesting for, and I think people who've been to funerals at this time will have had different experiences, is this idea of, if you can't go into church, of perhaps standing outside or standing outside people's homes. And I think people have had different experiences of that. My sadness about that is that I've had two occasions recently where one of the very elderly people in our parish community has died. And we just haven't had the chance to reminisce about the importance of that person in our lives, in the younger people's lives. And I do hope that people will do things next year. There will be memorials and that we won't just forget about it, because I think that could be a danger, really.
Mm. Mm. I think it's interesting, isn't it? We all talked an awful lot about big memorial services in 6 months. Which is what we thought. And in a year or whenever, I wonder how much people will have moved on, how much that will still be important. And I think that's a very careful gauging activity. But you know how churches used to, and probably still do, send out cards on anniversaries? I think that sort of thing is going to be so important, because there is a danger of, somehow in the whole corporate confusion and sense of loss, that the individuals can maybe drop through the net.
Mm. Yeah, the cards, yeah, lots. I'm sure people here have got lots of ideas as what they've been thinking about. Going on to talk a little bit perhaps about accompanying someone, as you've described it, either who is bereaved or approaching the end of life. What's been your experience of what you've learned about what can be helpful?
I think top of my list is be yourself. You don't have to have all the answers. All you have to do is just be yourself, be human. Try and match your demeanor to theirs. So if you're someone who cracks jokes all the time, it's probably not always appropriate to crack a joke, although raising a smile is never a bad thing. Just attend to them. Attend to how you're finding them that day, and that will vary, and then try and match your pace to theirs. Have you noticed, if you're sitting with a dying person, how slow everything becomes? I used to notice it when I was on call, because you'd come flying into the hospital at the rate of knots, you know, run up from the car park up to ITU to six floors into the room, and then suddenly there's stillness and silence, and my heart's, you know, and my breathing's still trying to cope with the six flights of stairs. And you just have to stop. And it's one of the things that I think family members find quite hard, is because they don't know what's happening, when it's going to happen, when they're going to get back to all the things that are in their email box and on their desks. And suddenly, apparently, there's nothing. And apparently, there's nothing you can do. And that's the hardest thing, is because you want to do something. We all want to do something, and actually you just have to learn to be, and you have to be in the moment, and you have to be still. And if the other people who are in that room, the family members, are stressing, which is not unreasonable, then you have to kind of hold their anxiety as well. And that's quite a big thing to hold. But don't be afraid when people start a conversation about death. Listen, respond, hear their question, make sure they know they've been heard. It's said that if people raise a conversation about death and you brush it off, they may never try that again. And that's sad. Mm. And then afterwards, give yourself lots of time to reflect on your thoughts, your feelings. It's not unreasonable that you may feel a bit battered. Take care of yourself. Give yourself a treat. But it means you can go back in and do it again another day, because these are such important conversations.
Mm. Yes, yeah. And so leading on to this, and we've sort of alluded to it, but we've alluded to the fact that the whole situation has perhaps made us all think about our own mortality and made us think about our own death and what we would want. And so would you like to share a little bit about that aspect of this and how important that can be?
I think it's positive. I think it's a matter of life and death. It's not and or, it's both and, not the other thing. Our death is the ultimate conclusion of our lives. We cannot change that. Many long-held religious traditions have always suggested that we should live every day with our dying in mind. There are saints who lived with a skull on their desk so that, you know, they knew their own mortality. We do it on Ash Wednesday, don't we? We have those ashes on our heads. But how much do we really take it on board? Well, I think human survival, we're actually pre-programmed that we can't entirely take our own deaths on board, but we can be realistic. If we've planned our own death to the best of our ability, because we don't know how or when, but it's going to be an awful lot easier for those we leave behind. If they know what we want, if they know what we hope for, we may not get what we hope for, but at least they can work towards that. And if we plan for our own death, I think we can be more at peace with ourselves. Again, my hospital experience is that, you know, people would be very anxious and the thoughts would go round and round in their heads. Who shall I ask for this? What sort of funeral do I want? Da di da. And you just say, for goodness sake, write it down, get it done, tell your loved one, and then put it in a bottom drawer. You don't have to think about it anymore. You can think about it, but cut the cycle of anxiety. So we know that a huge percentage of us haven't written wills. I know that I have a lasting power of attorney on my jobs list, which has been there for about 5 years. We're not good at it. But honestly, I think if you can, just get put your things in order, as they say, then you can get on and live life to the full for as long as you've got and for whatever that brings.
Yes, I think there's so many interesting things there to explore. I'm conscious this thing you said earlier on about don't brush the conversation about death away. And that can sometimes be hard with a family member because you don't want to think about them dying, you know, and I think that's an interesting area. And I know with my own mother, who's nearly 87, who keeps telling me she's in God's waiting room. And then I keep saying to her, oh, you're going to be with us for another 10 years, you know, and in a way, maybe that's not a good thing to do. So I think that whole area about how we have those conversations is really, really important. And maybe without being too overly optimistic, it's one of the many things that might come out of the pandemic, a positive thing. So now I'm going to hand over to Helen and to yourselves, and Helen's going to put some of the questions to Lynn that are coming up.
Great, thank you for that. I've loved listening to that, but I was taking notes because I was aware I had to concentrate in two ways. So that was quite interesting for me, just when it struck me how you talked about being. And that when you're with alongside someone who's dying, you just have to be, and your to-do list has to go on hold and all those things. So there are those different ways. I wonder if we could start perhaps from a very religious question, actually, because you mentioned that for people of faith, around death there is hope, and faith is hope. But what about when there's a mismatch between perhaps a family member doesn't have hope, but you do, and that's a gulf that can open up at the time when they're at the end of life. How might you advise someone to deal with that?
I think you can only meet people where they are, and I don't think deathbed conversions aren't unheard of, but I don't think you can assume for them. what we've seen in our church certainly is the very sad situation where somebody has great faith, has been regularly attending church or having, you know, visits at home. They die, the family member swoops in, clears the house, does the funeral, and no more is heard. That's sad for the congregation, and it's probably sad for the person as well. So it speaks into making your wishes known, making sure that even if you've told your family, who may not believe and practice, that you would like a church funeral, somebody to attend, a minister or priest to attend in your last days. Hopefully they will know that and accept that. But sharing that somehow within your church community as well offers maybe perhaps a little lever. We've had situations where it's all we've got so caught up with data protection and everything now, haven't we? That if the person hasn't explicitly consented for a priest to visit in their last days of life, then the care staff have no authority to admit them if the relative hasn't said yes. Oh, isn't it horrid? So the things we used to take for granted, and the thing that a hospital chaplain, of course, has the great advantage over, because you can just slip in, facilitate the conversation. When it's outside of a situation where the chaplain, just making your wishes known to a few people might help.
So I think that's kind of positive guidance, that actually last minute things, you can't change things easily at the last minute. So it is about the planning. And I like that point about actually sharing the responsibility with the community. So it's not just, you know, your responsibility, but you can ask for help and for wider support. And yes, going gently on these matters, particularly around hope. I think that might relate to another question that's kind of come up, because it's about community support, and it's kind of saying about the role of prayer, which you've raised, and that perhaps the church is re-looking at prayer ministry in the light of the pandemic and relating to that. So how might you see that developing?
I think the Church of England was very proactive, wasn't it, with its daily prayer line, which you could tap into at any time. I think what we can do with Zoom, with the links on Facebook, with the YouTube, is all good. On a local level, it's about tapping people into that, isn't there? I still notice in our parish an enormous reticence to get in touch. Oh, well, we don't want to bother. If only we could break through that. You know, keep talking to us. Tell us how you are. Tell us what you need. Tell us if you'd like someone to call. But people are very polite. And older people, I think if you're over 90, you're just inbred into you not to bother anyone, isn't it? So I would love to break down some of those barriers between people who probably would appreciate some support and facilitating the joining with the vast army of volunteers we've got, who would actually like to give some support. I don't quite know how.
I do think I think you're flagging up something there, though, that it's about the bigger community, and it's about having an honest attempt to find ways to respond, even if we don't have the answers immediately. That would be a long-term commitment, wouldn't it? Still saying a bit on the realm of faith, and this is perhaps a bit more about funerals, and it's about planning, but it's also about planning perhaps when you're thinking your funeral might be live streamed, and how does that affect how you're thinking about it? So, you know, you might have planned your hymns and all that kind of thing, but thinking that, is anybody taking that on board?
I'm not quite sure. We can't sing still, can we? That's my biggest pain, I think. Somebody asked me, what is your biggest pain of the pandemic? And I couldn't think, and then I remembered, it's probably not being able to sing in church. So funerals, live stream funerals, are a very strange thing. They're a necessity. I'm so grateful that is able to be put on, because if you can't attend, then at least you can join in some way. I used to sit here in this very little room with my funeral service, praying along with somebody who I knew was being buried that day, but with no IT. And then suddenly you could get into the creme. But having said that, they're quite stilted, aren't they? And they need to be quite quick. But they don't provide that mutual sense of gathering together in faith, I don't think, quite as much as if you had the full church with the choir and the organ and it's me enjoying the music.
I think those are useful reflections on how it's different. And I guess that is when you're planning your funeral, you plan your ideal, like you say, with the music and all those things. And then if you're thinking you're planning your funeral and the ideal isn't going to be possible, there isn't going to be singing. And I think there are varied responses that some people find it really helpful to be live streamed into a funeral, and some actually find it deeply distressing to not be there, and particularly someone who lives alone to live stream into a funeral. That can be very difficult, can't it? So it's just, I suppose, the specifics around the pandemic, just nuanced in the planning, really.
I've heard of gatherings in car parks. You know, if you can't go into the Chapel of Rest, you can at least gather in the car park or at the cemetery. There's this wonderful thing we've seen of people lining the streets. And I'd like to see that continue. I'd like to see everybody who sees a hearse go by stop and just pay their respects. But if you've chosen Abide With Me and you can't sing it, at least your relatives can play it at home afterwards, or they can play it possibly, you know, during the service. So it's getting that next best all the time, isn't it? And I think that's really helpful for those who are planning the service.
Yeah, and we've had an interesting question come through about, is there any, as we perfect our techniques really on different ways of doing funerals, do you think there's going to be any potential for the interaction to be two-way? Because live streamed is one way, but in terms of what people can offer in, I guess potentially that could be one response.
Many years ago, I sat around the bed of a dying person and prayed with them while their family member, can't remember, in Australia joined in. So there's no reason why you couldn't have input from somebody coming down the line into the chapel, whether it's done or not, I don't know. I don't see any reason why not. We certainly have videos.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think that, as you say, because we've got the second wave coming, it's not like, oh, well, we worked out how to do it in the first wave. Actually, we can keep improving how we're doing it and keep learning from it so that things can be even more positive. And it seems, yeah, that could be one really good development.
It's definitely not going back to normal, is it? It's going forward to the very best we can do. Onward.
I'm going to change the topic a little bit from sort of funeral and bereavement to thinking about towards the end of life and the sense of, you know, you mentioned how people often have to respond to quite tricky medical questions around the care that they're receiving and around drugs. And do you feel that there's been a change perhaps during the pandemic that perhaps end-of-life care, does it have to have more conversations about assisted dying? Is that coming in, or is it still very individualised?
I haven't heard much about, I mean, I'm not into every loop by any means, but I haven't heard very much about assisted dying during the pandemic. I suspect that it may be because the majority of people who are dying fairly acutely. The people who tend to be asking for assisted dying are with long-term degenerative illnesses. And now the big worry of the pandemic is that these are the people who have become hidden. You know, we've seen the figures, haven't we? Far less referrals for cancer, etc. But I suspect that people who have long-term degenerative illness will have been shielding. Now, if they're not IT literate, they'll just have been very quiet on their own, won't they? So I think I don't obviously the needs haven't changed, but I'm not sure that the conversation has been very much in the headlines.
Yeah, which I think perhaps it's interesting to note that it hasn't. And I can see a reason about acute, but that's maybe just something we all need to perhaps be a bit more aware of to think around. And then again, thinking about end of life care, we'd like to hear a little bit more about the silence and the role that that plays, and perhaps if it's got therapeutic or what benefits that you feel that it has.
To try and remember my thesis now. What I found was that silence as care, and of course, when I opened up Pandora's box about silence, it was massive because silence can be very negative. But I wasn't looking at a negative silence. I was looking at silence which could offer care. So I was talking to chaplains about their silence. But of course, their silence was always wrapped up in the silence of the other person. But what we found was that silence has occurred in all sorts of ways in conversations. So you may start being quite silent. You may precede prayer by silence, and that takes you down into the centre of yourself, doesn't it? Then a deeper conversation tends to emerge. Equally, you could have a very deep conversation with somebody, and then that will naturally tail off into silence, and that's a kind of honouring. And again, so important to hold it. You know, our very natural desire is to chat away, and if somebody lapses into silence, especially if that's someone who's grieving or grieving their own life, you know, it's quite easy to sort of think of another question to keep the conversation going. And actually, those silences are so valuable because they give the person the time to be with themselves in a way that they quite possibly could not be on their own. And that helps them to come to terms with, to realise, to make sense of, and then possibly to articulate some deep concern. If you can then talk through these concerns, then the experience of chaplains was that you often saw people die very peacefully, you know, within maybe a few days. So people who'd been unable to admit that they were dying, had been fighting, had been shutting family members out, shutting the medics out, shutting all conversations out, with a lot of very well-judged and very experienced handled silence, suddenly it would come out, "I'm dying, aren't I?" And that's, you know, it's massive. And then you need to honour that. And then there was the time for a very gentle exploratory conversation. And then at that point, the person would say, "Well, actually, no, I think I can talk to my family about this." And then would come the peace, and then would come the comfortable death. So just so important in so many ways. I discovered different layers of silence. I could go on for about 40,000 words, I won't, but different layers of silence, different ways that silences occur. And it just seems to be such a valuable part of what we do with people when they're dying, when they're bereaved, but actually when you meet people at the bus stop. I know I change from what I would describe as superficial conversation. I tune in when I hear somebody begin something which is a bit more serious, and I feel myself still focus, give them my attention, and let them say what they need to say. And that I think that is health giving. I think that's really important. It's something we can all do in our everyday lives.
Thank you. I think that way you've described silence is powerful and beautiful. And I love the idea that when your silence is like enfolding another person's silence, and that just seems such a wonderful role for a chaplain that probably non-chaplains might aspire to. But behind that is a sense of it does take a bit of practice. You kind of, the way you're talking is you've got to get into the zone of silence, and particularly when silence is shared. Because I think traditionally we think of silence as aligned with solitude, but the idea of silence when it's shared, and it's shared for a common purpose, is powerful. And it might relate to another question that we've received, and that's, how do you ever get someone to talk about death and dying when they're resisting it? And I think perhaps you've touched on that, that maybe shared silence is one of the things that you might need. Would there be anything else that you would say in that painful situation when a person can't face it? Is there anything else that might help?
I think you can only let people move at their own speed. I had a very close friend who was adamant that she didn't want to talk about her death. And she was very upset by the nurses who came in and tried to, in her view, force those conversations. I wouldn't want to say, but open those conversations. So it's, you can only move at the pace of the person with you. You need to keep offering the opportunity, but you don't want to ram it down their throat, because if you're not ready to accept, you're not ready to accept, and that's the end. And some people, unfortunately, do go to their deaths not accepting. And I have seen some painful deaths that way as well, physically painful deaths, which is all a lot tied up with this, what we call spiritual pain, I think. But being there for someone, building confidence, it doesn't happen in 2 minutes. You have to build a relationship of trust, and that can take time. That can take different times and approaches. In the hospice, I was always astounded by how quickly people opened up to me when I walked in the room. But in the hospital, I do have one memory of a lady who was non-practicing, and she was in and out of the hospital all the time. And every time she came in, I used to stick my head around the door with just that smile that said, I know you don't want to see me, but just to say hello, I've noticed you're back. And it was literally 5 years or more after I met her that one day she said, come in, I want to speak to you. And I sat down on the bed with her and she said, my husband died yesterday. And I didn't know what to say. It was a bit of me that wondered, you know, if got drugs or something that had affected her. But no, her husband had died in a different bed, in a different ward. And I was the person she wanted to speak to that day, because I firmly believe, because I hadn't pushed myself any day previously. So you just have to be there and just be patient and wait, and it may come. And it may not come for you. And if it's a relative, Carol, you were saying about, you know, with your mother, I was shocking with my mother. It's much, much harder when they're your own relatives. Sometimes you need that third party who could be a close friend, could be a minister or chaplain, somebody who they're not going to have to see again, the family's not going to have to see again, they can open up to in a very, very quiet and confidential way. So don't be embarrassed if that person's not you. For me, with my mum, her carer was the one that she hugged, kissed, cuddled, and spoke philosophically with. She didn't want to do it with me. And I was the chaplain.
So that's it. So that is your response, though, to that is actually because you recognised you weren't the most important person. And sometimes when we're wanting to look after someone, we can actually feel we're important. And it must take a massive humility to say, I'm just so glad that this important person is getting the care they need. And then I guess you have to go away and deal with it yourself. How you feel about it wasn't you, but how fantastic that she did have that.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm, yeah. Lots of people are very interested in your talking on silence, and we're hoping that you've published your PhD or you make it available or we can read more things. So I think if you let us know afterwards so we could share with people how they can really sort of look into that more and explore, that would be fantastic. I'm aware that time's pressing. I'm aware I could listen to you speak for hours. So I don't take it on too long, but I'd really like to thank you, because I think that you've covered so much ground there, and you know, about other people's approaching end of life, being with people at the end of life, the perspective from a chaplain and other professionals involved, and then on to the funerals. So that's actually been, you know, we called this seminar A Matter of Life and Death. There've been lots of matters there, and I think that there is this very clear thread about care and wanting the best for people that goes right through, and the challenge that in the pandemic perhaps we have to sometimes it's just tweaking our practice, isn't it? So that the values are the same, but we have to tweak our practice. So I don't know if there's any one last comment you'd like to add before we sort of draw to a close.
No, thank you very, very much for having me. It is just such an important conversation, and I'm so pleased to see the wonderful work that you're doing. Just really, really important, and thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Leeds Church Institute. To find out more about the Leeds Church Institute, visit lcileeds.org.